If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Plenty coming your way this hour. Later, Kate Payne on the suspension of Iowa City's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Also, good news in the battle against COVID. An update on that from IPR's Natalie Krebs. In the second half hour, you won't want to miss this, we'll hear from Chris Merrill of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program about the plight of a Burmese poet with Iowa ties and how that ties into defending our own freedom of expression. But first, let's check in with Katarina Sestarek, IPR state government reporter. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. Plenty of action at the State House this week. Let's run through a number of things advancing. Can you update us on the possible changes to Iowa's handgun law?
Right. The Iowa House of Representatives passed a bill on late Wednesday night that would end the requirement to get a permit to acquire a handgun or carry a concealed weapon. So under current law, Iowans have to get a permit through their county sheriff. And if they pass a background check, then they get the permit. And then it lasts for 5 years. And so this bill would remove that requirement. But Republicans who are pushing this bill say that people will still have to get a background check through the federal system when they go buy a gun from a federally licensed dealer. But if it's a private sale, this now removes the permit requirement to have a permit to buy a gun from a private seller. And so Democrats are very concerned that this will open further loopholes for people to get guns without background checks. Republicans say that they think they've built in a safeguard by raising the penalty for selling a gun to someone who shouldn't have one. But Democrats say that it's just not enough. And so this bill passed Wednesday with one Democrat joining all Republican lawmakers in the House to vote for it.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, remembering our previous discussions, Katarina, Iowa, should this make it to the governor's desk for her signature, Iowa would join about 18 or 19 other states that have similar permitless carry laws, right?
That's by some counts, that's how many states have that. And so, you know, Republicans say that Iowa will be safer with this law because people who feel they need protection will be able to get a gun sooner. But Democrats say that getting a gun sooner, that could also extend to people who may have bad intentions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a tax bill making advances at the State House. Tell us about that, please.
The Senate passed a bill that would phase out the inheritance tax over 3 years and would also remove the income tax cut triggers, that so-called, that would allow further income tax cuts to kick in. And Democrats surprised Republicans by actually joining in and voting for this bill as well. So it ended up being a unanimous vote in the Iowa Senate. But this is something that there's still a lot that needs to be worked out. Of course, you know, Republicans always say that they want to cut taxes, but over in the House, they're saying we need more time to look at, you know, the federal relief that's coming in and how that could affect tax cut efforts in Iowa, and also looking at the state's revenue update. And so it's still not clear, you know, what kind of tax agreement will actually come out of this session.
Katarina, how much of a surprise was it that the Democrats were on board with this?
It wasn't maybe that surprising that Democrats supported the inheritance tax phase out, because that's something that some Democrats indicated support for earlier this session. But these income tax cuts, this would allow them to kick in potentially sooner. And this is something that, you know, when the original tax cut package was passed in 2018, Democrats didn't support. So it is kind of interesting that now some Democrats voted to support potentially phasing in those income tax cuts sooner.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, we've talked about this for a number of weeks, legislation advancing that would end economic incentives for these big tech companies, Facebook, Google, that control censor some would say online posts. Update us on that, please.
Senate Republicans passed a bill on Wednesday that would ban tax breaks and government contracts for major tech companies that are found by a court to have improperly censored protected speech. So it could affect cities and counties that have given economic incentives to companies like Facebook and Google to build data centers. This is something that Republican Senator Jake Chapman of Adel sponsored and brought on many Republican co-sponsors. He believes that social media companies are unfairly targeting conservative accounts when, you know, they say they're trying to root out misinformation and speech that tries to encourage violence and things like that. And so Democrats oppose this, saying that it'll hurt Iowa's economy and deter businesses from, you know, growing and creating new jobs in the state.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that they said if a court finds one of these big tech companies improperly blocks protected speech. But it's interesting how a court would find one of these companies blocking protected speech when the First Amendment protects us from government infringing on our right to free speech. I don't know if that came up in debate.
Right. Yeah, it did. And, you know, I think there are just so many legal questions surrounding this bill. And, you know, Senator Chapman even kind of alluded to that, saying, you know, he wants to send a message to these companies, and he's not really sure if this bill is going to be what, you know, he said takes them down, but he said that they will fall someday is what he said.
Okay. And finally, let's talk a little bit about legislation advancing this week that seeks to ban what its backers see as diversity training that is too divisive.
Republicans in the Iowa House passed a bill on Tuesday evening that would ban school curriculum and any diversity training that's mandatory for a government agency that teaches or promotes divisive concepts. And then, as defined in the bill, that includes things like teaching that the U.S. and the state of Iowa are fundamentally or systemically racist or sexist, and that an individual, by virtue of their race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously. And so this is something that Republicans were saying they believe there should be diversity and inclusion training, but they are concerned about how it's being conducted. And Democrats are pointing to these things and saying this is pretty vague, and it seems like it could stop things like implicit bias training for people working in the courts, things like teaching about systemic racism and certain parts of American history. So there were a lot of concerns about that brought up by Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And in your reporting, you brought up the fact that this is this legislation is similar to an executive order from former President Trump, which blocked a federal court. And then Joe Biden, the current president, has taken action here.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of similar to a previous executive order from Trump.
Okay. Well, thank you for the update. A lot going on at the State House this week. Katerina Sestarek, we're glad to have you there covering it for us, and we'll look forward to further updates in your reporting. Katerina Sestarek, IPR State Government Reporter, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's move on to Kate Payne to find out more about a couple of stories she's been covering this week. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Tell us more about this story in Iowa City, where the city council voted this week to suspend the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Give us some background there about its origins.
That's right. So first off, it's a temporary suspension until April 15th, so they will be back. But this is a commission that's charged with fact-finding, truth-telling, and reconciliation to bear witness to racial injustice in Iowa City. And it was created as one of a number of commitments the city made after the racial justice protest last summer. And it was really at the urging of young activists, passionate young activists, led by the group the Iowa Freedom Writers. And ultimately, this decision to suspend it came after four people associated with the commission resigned. So three commissioners, and then a recently hired facilitator.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything more about that, about what happened? Because in your reporting, the mayor, Bruce Teague, in Iowa City was very disappointed, to put it lightly.
Yeah, so all of the people who have resigned have put out their resignation letters, so folks can look at that. And basically, it comes down to a lot of infighting on the commission, a lot of bitterness, disrespect between some commissioners and between some commissioners and the public. As one of the former commissioners described it, the meetings were a melee, and they were plagued with strife and distrust. There was also a lot of struggle with just the fundamentals of running an open meeting. People are probably familiar with the very particular set of rules and procedures that govern these meetings, and some of the commissioners were new to this process and weren't familiar and didn't get the adequate training to sort of go along with the meeting procedures.
Mm-hmm. Kate, I know Truth and Reconciliation, that phrase, only in connection, really mostly in connection with the experience in South Africa following mm-hmm. the apartheid era. This is sort of akin to that, or the idea was to do something in that direction?
Absolutely. So really probing the history of racial injustice in Iowa City, prompting and facilitating really difficult conversations with the public, giving the public a space to bring their stories forward and have this public acknowledgement, a public airing of wrongs that have been done, and then putting forward ways to memorialize that, either through public art or other ways, and to reconcile, to have a sort of coming together after the fact. So something that activists are really passionate about, and certainly some of these young activists were incredibly disappointed, offended, honestly, that the city was even considering suspending this commission.
What does the mayor, Mayor Bruce Teague of Iowa City, have planned for the future here?
So the commission is on hold for a couple weeks until April 15th. In the meantime, the city is taking applications to fill these open seats through March 30th, and then the city plans to appoint those new members in early April.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a couple minutes to talk about another area you've been covering in Iowa news, progress on cutting costs that inmates in Iowa's county jails have to pay to make phone calls.
Yeah, so this was part of a years-long review process before the Iowa Utilities Board, which is able to regulate these costs. But it comes down to, it's going to make a big difference for Iowa families with incarcerated loved ones, for whom the cost of making and taking these phone calls is a major burden. You know, people having to budget for talking with their parents, with their children. And in the most expensive county, a 15-minute phone call that used to cost $14 will now be more like $3. And so that's, again, a major benefit for so many families. Especially when we think that so many people remain in jail because they can't afford bail. Cost is a huge barrier for them.
Mm-hmm. There's been a national advocacy group at work on this. Tell us about that and how these millions of dollars a year will be saved.
Yeah, so this was a big push from advocates at the Prison Policy Initiative. Like you said, a national group, and they've calculated that these rate changes will save Iowans $1 million a year, and they say that's a conservative estimate. But they have been working on this advocacy with the Utilities Board and hope to replicate their Iowa approach in other states, because this has been an interest of national policy advocates. Because, again, what we're seeing again and again is companies being able to drive up their rates targeted at vulnerable people who have no alternative because they're incarcerated. They have no other choice, no other way to talk with their families.
Okay, progress there. Thank you, Kate Payne, for the update, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter. Have a great weekend, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. Before we go to break, let's get a COVID update from Natalie Krebs, IPR's health reporter. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
Well, looking at our topics, a mix of good, a lot of good, some worrying news. Let's start off with the very good news. As of this week, no Iowa nursing homes, long-term care facilities have active COVID-19 outbreaks. Now, that's a huge milestone, isn't it?
That is a huge milestone for this state. As of Thursday morning, the last facility in Wapello County that had an outbreak was cleared. So we now have no long-term care facilities with an outbreak. I mean, this is an area where the virus has hit really, really hard. I was talking to the Iowa Healthcare Association today. I talked to them yesterday. They basically said that almost all of the state's nursing homes have had COVID-19 cases at this point. And, you know, COVID-19 deaths have affected about 40% of Iowa's COVID-19 deaths are, you know, residents of long-term care facilities. So this had a huge impact on these facilities. And it is huge news that there are no longer any outbreaks there.
Mm-hmm. And we have to keep in mind how many nursing homes and assisted living facilities, these long-term care facilities there are in Iowa. You brought out in your reporting some 700 nursing homes and assisted living facilities, and over 400 of these are nursing homes. So this is a significant number. And to be able to say right now, we hope it will stay that way, we don't know, no active COVID-19 outbreaks. Phenomenal.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, another point to make, the long-term care pharmacy partnership program through the federal government, they're the ones that are, you know, vaccinating these centers. They're going to be finished by the end of this month. So basically, you know, the end of these outbreaks can be attributed to the fact that, you know, all these residents are now mostly vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Another bit of really great news on the horizon, April 5th. A day that will go down in Iowa COVID history. I sounded a little bit like Roosevelt. At least I tried to. No, I didn't really, did I? Okay. April 5th, a day that will go down in Iowa COVID history. Tell us, what is the significance of April 5th now as of this week, according to Kim Reynolds, our governor?
Well, we still need to see a bit, but, you know, Governor Kim Reynolds announced this week that, you know, April 5th was the day that she was looking at opening up the vaccinations to everyone in the state. Now, that's pending, you know, this promise from the federal government that the vaccine allocation will greatly increase by the end of this month. She said, as long as that happens, she is going to open up all appointments to Iowans. Same thing as before, though, you know, that doesn't mean April 5th is going to come and everyone's going to get vaccinated within the next week. There's still a huge supply demand issue. So, you know, even if appointments open up on April 5th, it's going to be a while before everyone in the state can secure an appointment.
Mm-hmm. What is your sense of what may happen in April? Will we, assuming this supply continues to increase and Iowa gets its doses, mass vaccinations in April? April is really going to be a happening month in terms of getting shots in arms, right? It sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, if supply increases, as the federal government has said, April is going to be a huge month for vaccinating Iowans. We'll be getting more vaccines than we've ever had before. Reynolds also said, you know, with the possibility of kind of a steady supply coming, it means places can book out appointments more in advance. So like it might be possible if you log on in early April, you can get an appointment sometime in April. Currently, with supply not being that steady, they're doing it week by week. And so that's another thing that's been causing frustration and has sort of made it hard for people to get appointments.
Okay, two bits of really good news. Let's go to the worrying point that you reported on this week. What we've come to know as the UK variant. Worries in our state over that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so 38 new cases were announced by the Iowa Department of Public Health. I think that that brings the total to over 60, if I remember correctly, currently. This is a variant of the virus that's known to spread more easily. The good news in this is that the vaccines have been found to be effective against this. So it is sort of this race, you know. The state of health officials are encouraging everyone to get vaccinated when they can. Also encouraging everyone to keep up those social distancing measures, to wear a mask. You know, we don't want this to spread even further.
Right. And this brings to mind, Natalie, something. I don't know if you saw this in the news. I certainly watched the exchange between U.S. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky and Dr. Fauci, our nation's top infectious disease expert, where to more or less encapsulate, the Senator Paul was talking about the fact that more and more people being immunized, absolutely true, and then saying, I think his words were that masks are at this point in many cases a theater to wear a mask. And Dr. Fauci vigorously disagreeing with that. Masks are not theater at this point. Weigh in on this, Natalie. We have really bright spots, really good news this week, but masks are completely necessary, aren't they?
Yeah, and to your point, Ben, I've noticed that, you know, hospitalizations from yesterday, Thursday, to today, Friday, have crept up by about 20. You remember that more than half of the state's eligible population for the vaccine still hasn't been vaccinated. So this pretty much means that we still need to be following those safety measures, like wearing a mask, social distancing, you know, just because the vaccine's here, just because you see, like, you know, your friends, family around you getting vaccine appointments. Like, this is still very much spreading in the community. We need to be very, very careful, or we could risk another outbreak, another big wave, if we don't stay vigilant until we can kind of reach that herd immunity point for vaccinations.
Right. And we've been saying it for nearly a year that we've had to live with this pandemic. We have to say it once again, Natalie. Masks can never be a wrong decision. When you go out of your house, especially into a public area, a mask is never a bad option. It's, in fact, a good option. We want to get rid of this pandemic, get back to some normalcy. Social distancing, masks. We'll say it again and again, and we'll have to say it in the coming weeks, Natalie. Thank you for your update on the situation here in Iowa with our pandemic.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, caught up in the violence, detained and beaten by the military regime, a Burmese writer who not too long ago was part of a residency of writers from around the world here in Iowa. We'll hear about his plight from Chris Merrill, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. That's when we return with this News Buzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Legislature is in session.
Let's just go around. We got a lot of people.
There are proposals for constitutional amendments, education, taxes, the budget, and many policy bills.
So what needs to be fixed?
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, is following the session.
I want to thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
I'm John Pemble. Subscribe to the podcast or hear Under the Golden Dome on our website, iowapublicradio.org.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Ever since the coup in Myanmar on February 1st that overthrew the democratically elected government there, we've been hearing in our news about the dire situation, the loss of life, the brutality in that Southeast Asian nation formerly known as Burma. The military there has expanded martial law around the country following deadly protests. Last weekend, for instance, about 50 people were reported killed when troops and police opened fire on protesters in various areas. Caught up in the violence, detained and beaten by the military regime there, a Burmese writer who not too long ago was part of a residency, many-week residency of writers from around the world here in Iowa. Joining us to talk about the plight of Mong Yu Pai, the poet in question, Christopher Merrill, the director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Chris, always nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be with you, Ben.
Let's talk specifically about this poet, this former guest of the IWP. Tell us about his background and his time here in Iowa.
Well, Ben, Mong Yu Pai was here in the fall residency of 2015. He, at the time, we would have described him as a younger poet. He had published two books, and his work had been anthologized in a lot of important collections. He was a very nice young man, a poet who, you know, with two books would have been at the start of his career. He was arrested in the protests, and here's the part that gets crazy. He was arrested. His lawyer, who is also a poet, was then arrested for representing him. Yeah. Our understanding, this has not been confirmed, but our understanding is that he has been severely beaten in prison, and his crime is simply protesting what we regard as central to life in a free and democratic society. He's facing a prison sentence of 2 years, and that should be adjudicated in a few days' time.
Mm-hmm. Just to give those who don't know, listening, a little bit of context here. We've had thousands of protesters detained by the Burmese military for their part in these protests. They're demanding the release of the ousted civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. She heads what is called the National League for Democracy. And that party saw a landslide victory in last November's elections there. The military has detained most of the leadership of the party after their coup on February 1st. They allege fraud, voter fraud. No proof has been provided for that. Put this in a little bit more context, Chris, if you can. Add to what I say, because we are pointing out one poet for his connection here to Iowa, but there are many who are suffering under this military regime.
Well, at least nine poets have been detained, including another IWP alum, that's U Pei Mient, who served as Aung San Suu Kyi's Minister of Information. So it goes up and down the society. As you said, more than 2,000 people have been detained. More than 220 people have been killed. The police have used water cannons, rubber bullets, tear gas, and snipers using live ammunition on the people. And the protests, of course, are largely very peaceful. Mm-hmm. They're called the pots and pans protests. People are banging pots and pans and making a lot of noise. But they are assembling freely and peacefully. It is the military junta, the regime, that has taken such outrageous and such powerful measures against civilians, exercising what we in America would call our First Amendment, the right to free expression and the right to peaceful assembly.
Right, and they are simply protesting a return to leadership by the overwhelmingly democratically elected government and for freedom of expression. I wonder if you can give us an example of the, do you have a poem of Mong Yu Pai that you could share with us? Because in his poems, as you know, extending a great tradition of creative writing against oppression, his poems do the same. And you can, I think, see in his poetry, if you have an example, how the military leadership would not like what he has to say.
Well, we think of poets and prose writers as being truth tellers, and this is a particular kind of truth that Mong Yu Pai brings across in his poem called Under the Great Ice Sheet, translated by another IWP alum, Coco Tet, and the British poet James Byrne. It goes like this. Under the great ice sheet, a great country has been buried alive. Under the great country, a great church where God no longer shelters. Under the great church, the great wars, welded together 6 feet under. Under the great wars, a great museum of culture, dilapidated and yellowing. Under the great museum, banknotes without currency. Under the banknotes, slaves with protruding bones and sunken eyes. Under the slavery, a Stone Age cave sealed by stones. Under the Stone Age, regressive evolution. Under the evolution, the ocean, the mother of Mother Earth, who died in labor. Under the ocean, a great ice sheet, unanticipated. Under the great ice sheet. And then we have three dots and ellipsis pointing to the seemingly endless battle for free expression that human beings have waged from time immemorial. And we note the constant burrowing down under the great ice sheet, under the great country, under. It's as if the poet is drilling deeper into the very center of who we are as human beings to try to understand something about our condition. That's terrifying to the generals.
And what an apt image. They're a great ice sheet, so powerful, seemingly insurmountable. Comment a little bit more, Chris, and perhaps in other contexts you remember over the decades of poets, creative writers, finding ways to comment and criticize their oppressors, and it having actually a great effect.
Well, it's important to remember that the International Writing Program was founded in 1967, at least in part, to provide a way for writers and poets from all around the world, in the Soviet bloc principally at that time, and to meet with their counterparts from Western societies and have free and open discussions. I'm just thinking about my great friend, the Slovenian poet Tomáš Šalamón, who was thrown into jail in the 60s for the simple act of writing poems and editing a poetry cultural journal. He ended up here at the University of Iowa in the International Writing Program. He spent 2 years here because he was released from jail thanks to great international pressure exerted by newspapers at the time, like the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. But once he was released from jail in the former Yugoslavia, he couldn't find work. So we took him in here. By we, I mean the International Writing Program. And in a way, he's a kind of template for a certain kind of writer who has always been a part of our program, whether from Russia, from different parts of the Eastern Bloc, from China. In recent years, we've had poets and writers from Cuba, from Venezuela. There are, as we know, many oppressive regimes around the world. And one thing they always have in common is that they fear the poets and the writers, the truth tellers. And we at the International Writing Program like to provide a safe space for them whenever we can, in order that they can get their work done and share their stories with other poets and writers from around the world.
Back to the specific case of Mong Yu Pai, former resident of the the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. What action are you taking? What action can listeners take to support freedom of expression?
Well, immediately we've been circulating a petition calling on the regime to release all the poets, but also all civilians who have been caught up in this dragnet. And that's one way for us to put pressure on the regime. We can always turn to our elected representatives, the Iowa delegation, Senators Ernst and Grassley, different Congress people, just to bring this to their attention. Surely this is one of the matters being discussed at the negotiations in Alaska underway between Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and his Chinese counterparts. I would imagine this would be one of the subjects coming up because, let's face it, we can put as much pressure as we like on the military rulers, but they have China backing them up to a certain extent. We don't know how much China will back them up in these days, but that is a part of the great game of international politics. And whatever pressure that citizens can bring to the elected representatives to remind them of how important free expression is and peaceful assembly is to people all around the world. That's a way to start to make a difference.
Chris, we have about 5 minutes left. If you've just joined us, Chris Merrill, director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, talking about freedom of expression as we broaden this out. Of course, here in Iowa, we've had a case, a very stark case, climaxing last week, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, that focused the nation's and even the world's attention on an Iowa trial, a verdict last week in a case that raises concerns over press freedom, the First Amendment, against a backdrop of what has been a sharp increase in this country in recent arrests of journalists. I'm talking about the jury finding the Des Moines Register reporter Andrea Suhori not guilty of failing to disperse and interfering with official acts. A Des Moines police officer pepper sprayed and arrested Suhori, notably here, a Palestinian American, last May while she was on assignment at a Black Lives Matter protest outside of Merle Hay Mall. She repeatedly said, "I am the press. I am with the press." Nevertheless, she was treated in this way. That story is ongoing. How related is this, when we look at the world, your connection with all these stories in the world, how related is this story in Iowa to the theme we're talking about?
Well, the first thing that came to mind when Andrea was arrested last May was this hit very close to home for me. I cut my teeth as a journalist working as a stringer in the former Yugoslavia during those wars of succession. And the time I spent in Sarajevo under siege, getting shot at by snipers, I was well aware of the fact that journalists were being targeted there. They are often targeted in war zones because, again, they're bringing the truth to the situation, and that's usually a threat to authoritarian regimes. When it happened here, I was not entirely surprised because, of course, President Trump had spent 4 years calling journalists the enemy of the people. That's an old Stalinist term. I wasn't surprised, but I was horrified to see the things I had reported on around the world coming home to roost here, thanks in part to the president calling out fake news, calling journalists enemies of the state, enemies of the people. That's a recipe for disaster. And thank God Andrea was acquitted. I think a very quick return of the jury, because they were recognizing on the most basic level that what she was doing is exercising her free expression. Journalists have the right to try to see to tell that story, and she identified herself as a journalist, and that seemed to make no difference at all to the policeman who pepper sprayed her. And that's an indictment of all of us. And the more we try to push back against that kind of bad behavior, against the constant alarms about fake news, the better chance we have of settling our differences in a peaceful manner.
Right. And thank goodness for courageous journalists like Andrea Suhori of the Des Moines Register in such times. You, Chris, as director of the International Writing Program, also before being director, you travel the world for decades. You've been in dialogue with writers and their governments of all types. What's your view now that we have a new administration about, I don't know, 60 days in office? How quickly does that filter down to you? Does that make a difference in the sort of soft power that you would like to have influence the rest of the world through the International Writing Program?
Well, I think the Biden administration's recommitment to diplomacy, to restoring our traditional alliances around the world, is all to the good. The international program, yes, it's part of the soft diplomacy. It's what we would call cultural diplomacy, the free exchange of information and ideas, usually in a people-to-people context. And we're very much hoping that with the now now that the vaccinations regime has begun and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, we'll be able to welcome back to the University of Iowa in the fall 38 writers from 38 different countries, and it'll be one of our bigger residencies. These writers have been cooling their heels for quite some time, as in fact all of us have been around the world. But as I've often said, that we generally have in residence at the same time a writer from Israel and a Palestinian writer, and they often find they are always at complete odds politically speaking, but they often become pretty good friends. And what we try to create in the International Writing Program is this safe space where people from different lands, different languages, different faiths, different political affiliations have a chance to meet and talk and write, translate one another's work, carry on the kinds of dialogue that I think are essential to solving larger problems around the world. I'm completely heartened by the fact that the Biden administration has begun to take diplomacy seriously. That's why Anthony Blinken is in Alaska meeting with his counterparts. I understand that those discussions, which began yesterday, were pretty heated, but that's what diplomacy is. It's not easy, but it's painstaking work, but it is essential to countries around the world getting along. It's, as war is the continuation of politics by other means, it's also the continuation of diplomacy by other means. I'm all for continuing the diplomacy so that we don't get to the place where the shooting breaks out.
Okay. Chris Merrill, thank you for this conversation, and I applaud you, as I'm sure many listening do, for your work as director of the International Writing Program in watching the backs of our writers, those who are residents here, those who are not, those who are around the world, all those protecting the right of free expression. Chris, very quickly before we go, how do people find out more about the IWP and get involved with that petition and so forth?
If you go to our website, iwp.uiowa. If you go to our website at iwp.uiowa.edu, you will see the petition there. And we're starting to roll out the biographies of the writers who will be here in the fall. You can find all the information that you need there, as well as examples of Mung Yu Pai's poetry and other Burmese writers who have been in our program, all there on our website, iwp.uiowa.edu.
Christopher Merrill, always a pleasure. An honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Ben.
Time enough to be grooved into the weekend by Mark Simmet of the IPR Studio One team. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Well, I think we have time for one tune. The week's not turning out too bad, weather-wise, brightening up, warming up. I don't know if your tune has anything to do with that or goes in the opposite direction.
Well, this tune, you could interpret this in different ways. It could be a commentary on politics, perhaps, or interpersonal relationships, I think, ultimately, is what it's all about. The weather, well, the weather enters into everything, I guess. But we have a song for you from a new release by Jimbo Mathis and Andrew Bird. Jimbo Mathis, one of the founders of the band Squirrel Nut Zippers. Some of you may recall that band from a couple decades back. Andrew Bird was a collaborator with them for a few albums in the mid to late 90s before going on to his own solo career, very successful solo career that continues to this day. But the two of them remained friends, kept in touch, and they decided to do an album together, just the two of them. It's a new release. It's called These 13, referring to the 13 songs that they wrote together. And one of them is this one, as I said, seems to be talking about interpersonal relationships and has fun playing around with different cliches having to do with hatchets and axes and that sort of thing. It's a song called Dig Up the Hatchet.
Dig up the hatchet and pass it around. Dig exhume these memories from the cold ground. And if you truly believe that two wrongs make a right, then we'll dig up a hatchet tonight. Bring up your boyfriend from way back home. Mention those pictures you found on my phone. Then we'll tumble and fall into a hollering fight. We'll dig up the hatchet tonight.
Very nice selection there, Mark Simmet. I find myself grinning ear to ear listening to those lyrics. Let's listen to a few more in just a moment. But Mark, thank you very much for grooving us into the weekend. Mark, with Tony Daner and Cece Mitchell, your IPR Studio One Tracks hosts. Mark, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
And River to River is produced in this case today by Matt Alvarez. Also help today from Jason Burns in Ames. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
Do they believe that two wrongs make a right? Then we'll dig up the hatchet tonight. Like the bramble and the rose, we are hopelessly entwined. And we'll find ourselves a new axe to grind. You gotta dig up the hatchet again.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.